Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Wednesday, May 22nd. Thank you for joining us. I'm Mark Sappenfield.
And I'm Eva Botkin-Kowacki.
No matter who triumphs in the National Basketball Association playoff game between the Milwaukee Bucks and the Toronto Raptors tomorrow, there will be a clear winner. Africa. On one side is the Bucks' Giannis Antetokounmpo, the Greek-born son of Nigerian immigrants who is rapidly becoming the best basketball player on the planet. On the other are rising Raptors star Pascal Siakam of Cameroon, and general manager Masai Ujiri, a Nigerian seen by many as one of the game's shrewdest executives. The NBA's connection with Africa is growing. The league now frequently plays a preseason game in Africa, and another of the league's transcendent young talents is Cameroon's Joel Embiid. Mr. Ujiri says there are 10 Embiids walking around Africa waiting to be discovered. That effort begins in earnest next year when the NBA launches a Pan-African professional league of 12 teams. The benefits for the NBA are obvious, but the symbol for Africa is potentially even more potent. The continent is still struggling to overcome lingering colonial views of its art, justice, people, and economy. The NBA venture can be the reverse, a mutual investment in the promise of Africa's future. This new league could be the most important lens through which Africa's history of vibrant talent, culture, history, and beauty is celebrated, write a Kenyan lawyer and his colleague in the Toronto Star. It might just be the world stage Africans have long dreamed of and patiently waited for. Now on to our five stories today, which include a look at one of the paradoxes of hyperpartisanship in the United States. A first-person account of what it's like to vote with nearly a billion friends, and why fashion's repeated cultural faux pas are eminently avoidable. Our first story. The vote for the European Union Parliament this week is one of the most consequential in the organization's history. At issue is the spirit of Europe's post-World War II identity.
Starting on Thursday, European voters in 28 countries over 5 days will take part in the second largest democratic exercise in the world. And the election will reveal just how strong the politicians seeking to undermine the European Union really are. For decades, the parliament has been controlled by a grand coalition of center-right and center-left political groups. But the two big centrist political families are projected to lose about 70 seats each. A variety of Europhobic parties are expected to pick most of them up and to control one-third of the parliament. These parties range from Euroskeptics dubious about the value of more integration to outright enemies of the whole idea of a European Union. Jan Teschau, an analyst with the German Marshall Fund of the U.S., a Berlin-based think tank, says that after the elections, the European Union will look like the new Europe, where populist parties are prominent in almost every nation. He adds that the EU is a compromise machine. If the next parliament and other key EU bodies include significant numbers of anti-EU politicians, he says, that is going to get more difficult. This story was reported by Peter Ford in Paris for The Monitor.
It can be hard for Congress to pass legislation when there are sharp partisan differences. But on infrastructure, there's actually plenty of agreement. Turns out, these days, that can be a problem too.
When President Donald Trump took office some 2.5 years ago, 2/3 of Americans regarded improving the nation's infrastructure as very important. Last December, again, Americans ranked infrastructure as one of the top priorities for the incoming Congress. Yet despite another infrastructure meeting today between Mr. Trump and Democratic leaders, there's little evidence of a deal on the horizon. Funding remains a sticking point. An analysis by the American Society of Civil Engineers showed that it would cost nearly $4.6 trillion to repair the country's bridges, dams, and sewage systems. Infrastructure is also not a big topic on the campaign trail. Aside from trillion-dollar proposals by Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar and former Maryland Representative John Delaney, infrastructure has largely been absent from the 2020 conversation. Why would an issue with so much bipartisan agreement be garnering so little traction or attention? For precisely that reason, because it doesn't allow candidates to draw a clear contrast. The basic position is just, let's fix it, says Laura Stoker, a political science professor at the University of California, Berkeley. This is a really hard issue to differentiate between the parties, or to differentiate you from someone else. This story was reported by Timmy Broderick in Washington for The Monitor.
Paradise, California is a portrait of what happens long after TV cameras leave following a disaster. What residents are finding is that emotional recovery, like rebuilding itself, takes care and patience.
Last November, the deadliest wildfire in California history killed 85 people and razed almost 14,000 homes in the town of Paradise. 6 months later, a sense of stunned disbelief lingers among thousands of displaced residents. "We lost more than our home," says Pam Fender, who lived in Paradise with her husband for 25 years. "We lost our community. We lost our way of life." Residents reeling from the fire's aftermath have sought support from crisis workers, mental health therapists, clergy, and most often, from each other. "What we tell people is, there's no timeline. Heal at your own pace," says Jake Fender, Ms. Fender's son, who helps run a disaster crisis counseling program. "Because the truth is, nobody knows how long it's going to take." The town's gradual rebuilding poses a conundrum for residents coping with the emotional trauma wrought by the fire. Their fondness for Paradise conflicts with an awareness that the place they knew has vanished. Margaret Kelly, who lost her home of 40 years and her job, has turned to hiking and biking to ease her mind. But doubts about the town's future trail her. "The world came together to help Paradise," she says. "I just hope people don't forget us." This story was reported by Martin Kuz in Paradise, California, for The Monitor.
Many fear that the rise of Hindu nationalism has tied Indianness to religion. But being Indian also means taking part every day in the largest democratic experiment on earth.
When India's elections kicked off on April 11th, reporter Sarita Santoshini was there to see it, there to vote, in fact. In her home state of Assam, in India's far northeast, she and her parents drove to the school where voting machines had been set up, and, it turned out, frequently broke down. And then she waited her turn in a long line of women. This Sunday, the last of the seven waves of voting found her in the city of Kolkata, where political tensions have sometimes flared into violence. As she walked from neighborhood to neighborhood, taking in the on-edge atmosphere, she asked some of the country's 900 million eligible voters what had brought them out to the polls amid the tension. For some, it was jobs and the economy. But she also heard concerns about this staggeringly diverse country's sense of unity. Many fear that polarization is on the rise and that animosity towards minorities is building and finding sanction from politicians. "I have been urging people to vote sensibly because I believe that democracy is at threat," one voter told her in a largely Muslim neighborhood. "There have been clashes along religious and caste lines in the rest of the country. This was never the case in West Bengal. It's slowly being provoked here as well, and we should stop that." This story was reported by Sarita Santoshini in Kolkata, West Bengal, India, for The Monitor.
Sometimes fashion designers make dreadful decisions, inadvertently mocking entire groups of people. But the answer is easy. More diversity in the design room. And often, it is a financial boon, too.
When a friend texted Brandice Daniel a photo of a Gucci sweater that evoked the image of blackface, she was deeply disappointed. But as founder and CEO of Harlem's Fashion Row, Ms. Daniel, who is African American, saw a chance for progress. Raised in Memphis, Tennessee, she says lessons from the civil rights movement are often on her mind. If history teaches us anything, it is that usually things get worse before it gets better, says Ms. Daniel. Mulling over the sweater, she thought, there's a benefit here. Her openness to possibilities was validated by an invitation to attend a meeting alongside other industry influencers of color in Harlem with Marco Bizzari, Gucci's chief executive officer. Soon after, Gucci announced a sweeping new diversity initiative. Fashion brands are increasingly calling on the expertise of individuals like Ms. Daniel, a veteran resource for designers of color, to help launch diversity initiatives. As the imperative for inclusivity grows, however, the challenge remains for these campaigns to avoid tokenism. This story was reported by Sarah Matusik for The Monitor.
Now, commentary on an exception in the world of autocrats from The Monitor's editorial board. In an era of strongman rule from Egypt to China, it is refreshing to see a new leader on the world scene who tries not to act like a personal hero, but operates with compelling modesty. On Monday, Volodymyr Zelensky was sworn in as the elected president of Ukraine. One of his first requests? Don't hang his picture in the government offices. The novice politician won a landslide victory based on his popularity in a TV show in which he plays a humble schoolteacher elevated to the presidency. As a real-life president, he continued the theme of humility by walking to his inauguration, refusing an honor guard, and eschewing the haughty ways of the oligarchy that has dominated one of Europe's poorest countries. By its claim to openness, self-reflection, and denial of taking credit, humility is a great way to learn. Today's autocrats pretend they are all-knowing, which leads them to make critical mistakes and demand personal rule without checks and balances. Russians are noting how much Mr. Zelensky differs from their president. In his inauguration, Vladimir Putin arrived in a bulletproof car with the streets of Moscow cleared of people. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thank you for joining us today. Tomorrow, our Beijing staff writer, Ann Scott Tyson, will look beyond the United States and China to explore how the trade war between the two countries is touching far more of the globe. With European Parliament elections just around the corner, today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor explores how seeing others the way God made them can help us keep our cool and foster harmony even in contentious situations. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Rebecca Asulin, Tim Malone, and Jeff Turton.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2019.